All right. Well, good morning, everyone. And in spite of the fancy-sounding title, this is definitely an experimental talk. So what I want to be telling you about is an experimental narrative of how people in a laboratory begin to understand geometrical or topological forces using experiments we can actually do. So at the sort of cartoon level, this is the outline of my talk. I'm going to present two experiments, although we'll see the first one is more styled as an introduction about how we realized a type of charge pumping that I'll call geometric charge pumping, predominantly to distinguish it from topological charge pumping. And then I'll have the majority of my talk focused on what we'll call generalized geometric forces, or how can you measure forces that result from the various geometric properties of the eigenstate structure of a Hamiltonian. Okay. And those are the experiments I'll be presenting, but the actual structure of the talk is this. So what I want to lead off with is my sense of physical forces. So we're going to think about atoms in an optical lattice and try to understand what happens when you push on them or pull on them and shake them back and forth, and how this doesn't really capture everything that a force could be. In fact, you don't see a lot of force-like effects. We're then going to use this kind of thinking to understand the phenomena of geometric or topological charge pumping. All right, so we'll go from pushing on things to quantum forces. We're going to then take the ideas we developed with these topological or geometric pumps and revisit them in a recovery period using two-level systems. So if you're an atomic physicist, the two-level system is like rest and recovery. So we're going to use that as rest and recovery. And then after that we're going to think about these generalized geometric forces. We're going to construct a more complicated four-level system and see how we can see non-abelian type gauge fields appear and the forces that result from those. All right, so this is the general structure of the talk, and it's going to become progressively more experimental as we go along. So once I introduce the concepts that were foreign to me when we started this, we'll begin to see how they play out in the laboratory. All right. So the first part of my talk, we're going to think about pumps. We're going to think about systems where you have a crank, like in the Archimedean pump. And in the lab, we're going to control the phase of a laser field. And as we control the phase of that laser field, we're going to ask, how does the atom subject to the resulting optical potential actually move when we turn that crank? So the Archimedean pump sort of contains the intuitive idea about this crank-turning pumping idea, that every time you execute a single turn of the pump, you would expect that the thing being pumped, in this case the water fluid, to move in more or less a quantized amount. Okay? Of course, it's not really quantized with an Archimedean pump, but every cycle you get about the same amount of stuff. Sort of in the lineage of pumps, the Archimedean pump is the ancient ancestor to what we call the NIST single electron pump. So this is the single electron pump is about 15 years or 20 years old now. And so you can see 99. So the idea there is sort of a bucket brigade on these single electron transistors, where various voltages applied to these gates cause electrons to move one at a time down this array of metallic islands. Now I call this to be the descendant of the Archimedean pump, because the only thing quantum about this pump is the fact that the electrons come in units of E. Otherwise, it's the classical manipulation of potentials that moves charge between these buckets. So this is not a quantum pump. In this sense, I'll be describing quantum pumps. All right, it is more classical than it is quantum. Okay, so on to my discussion of forces. So we're going to be thinking about, for the first section of this talk, are atoms in an optical lattice potential. So we're going to envision a standing wave of light, and we're going to ask what happens if you put atoms in that standing wave of light and push on them. Okay, so you may recall, of course, that if you have a single one-dimensional sinusoidal potential, the resulting structure that the atoms experience is simply a band structure that looks like this. And the first question you might ask, if you sit atoms at the bottom of this band structure and simply apply a force, what does this force do in connection with your intuitive expectation of forces? And in atomic physics, where the scattering is very, very low, you see block oscillation. So it was hard in the condensed matter material systems, in fact, is the rules today with cold atom systems. An atom initially at that point experiences a force which gives a time change to the crystal momentum Q, and that wave packet moves to there, and the later time it moves to there, it finally block oscillates to the other side of the Brillouin on its own, and after one cycle of block oscillation returns to where it started. So this idea from condensed matter physics is sort of taken to its extreme in cold atom experiment. And these data are taken from cesium in the Innsbruck group. And what they observe is not one integer block oscillation, but rather 20,000 of them, okay, with hardly a decrease in contrast. And the idea there is they had a nearly perfect potential and also turned off the interactions between the atoms. So the upshot is, if you take a cloud of atoms in an optical lattice and push on it, its responses undergo block oscillations, and while block oscillating, it is shuttering back and forth. It undergoes no net motion, no center of mass motion. So if your goal is to move stuff, pushing on things in the lattice does not accomplish that goal. Right? So this, while we did apply a force, the force didn't do what we're used to forces doing. All right. So we might ask a different question. Moving stuff, applying forces, is not the only way to do it. Let's imagine this standing wave of light I'm envisioning. It's created by a pair of counterpropagating laser fields. You can see there's a sinusoidal modulation to this exponential, along with a phase that you can control in the laboratory. And as this phase is advanced, the relative position of this optical potential will change, and you might imagine the wave packet you load onto a particular side of this lattice would move. So I'm going to sort of set this up as a thought experiment, and there's some things that are a bit misleading about this slide, which I'll get back to in a second. But anyway, the idea is, okay, well, surely those atoms must move if you advance this lattice potential. So let's think about that next. Well, associated with this lattice potential is the band structure I previously showed. So we'll be talking about band structure for a bit, so I'm going to talk about the horizontal axis as being crystal momentum. I may slip up and call it quasi-momentum from time to time. That's sort of a cold atom lingo. And the important thing that I'd like to call your attention to here is that, indeed, there's an effective mass, a change in the curvature near zero crystal momentum. And how does this relate to pumping exactly? Well, the way you can think about this phase modulation experiment is, if you have a lattice, the sides of which are my fingers, as we advance the phase, my fingers move. Okay? It's kind of inconvenient to think about an experiment where my fingers are at rest. They begin moving and they stop moving. That's the question we're going to ask, because what happens to atoms when you do that? It's a bit more convenient to think about this experiment in the frame of my fingers. So I'm starting at rest, I'll just move with my fingers and I'll stop again. So the series of two frame transformations required to go from the at-rest configuration to the moving configuration, back to the at-rest configuration, each of these frame transformations in the frame of the atoms, in order to have a static Hamiltonian from my point of view, when I begin moving, I impart a net velocity in my moving frame. This makes sense, right? If there's no lattice present, as I began to move, the atoms would be left behind. And when I stop, they'd stop again. So in my frame, the frame of the moving person or the moving lattice, if the lattice were absent, you'd expect the atoms to have undergone a net negative displacement. In this picture of an optical lattice, the amount of displacement you get, you need to think about force. The force in this case resulted from is described by a change of momentum or change of crystal momentum at the beginning of this near instantaneous change in velocity. However, the change in momentum, that's the horizontal displacement on this graph, doesn't quite give the change in velocity you were expecting, owing to the different effective mass in the situation. All right. So the net displacement you're going to see after having undergone this experiment, this thought experiment, is the overall displacement that the lattice experienced here, that's delta t times v lattice. That's what you're going to expect. Less the contribution owing to the curvature of this band structure here. Okay. The reason here is that the free particle dispersion is slightly different than this effective mass here. This gives an overall displacement, which would be an optical wavelength, less the contribution from the curvature. So what I'm saying is that if the lattice is completely absent, if you stayed in the lab frame, of course the atoms wouldn't move. But in the presence of a lattice, they can move by some amount, having on one component a dispersion relation term, and another term here resulting from the actual physical displacement. In the absence of the lattice, there's no displacement. These two terms are equal. And when the lattice is incredibly deep, the band is essentially flat, and the observed displacement is one lattice period. Okay, so the upshot here is that the amount of displacement is neither nothing, nor is it an integer amount associated with one lattice period per pump cycle. So it looks like I gave the abbreviated introduction here. The thing that's misleading about this is I drew a little picture here of a wave packet localized in a particular side of this lattice. And then I went on to describe a wave packet localized at the center of the Brillouin zone. And these are incompatible descriptions of the system. In fact, if you occupy each of these states with equal probability, as is necessary to construct this wave packet, you will indeed compute an integer displacement of one lattice site per cycle. All right, so this is the misleading thing that I was describing to you previously, is that there's nothing at all generic about the amount of displacement you have in this kind of system. It could be a quantized amount if you localize the atoms initially. It could be some totally non-generic amount if the atoms are unlocalized. Or again, it becomes essentially quantized in the limit of a deep lattice. It can be anything. All right, so this is an intuitive description of what happens in a 1D lattice. And now I'd like to begin moving along a different direction to try to understand this type of motion, these type of geometric forces in a different kind of way. All right, so what we're thinking of is a quantum system where we have a Hamiltonian that's going to be time periodic. In other words, the Hamiltonian returns to itself after one cycle of pumping. So we have a crank. I'm not specifying what that crank is, but we turn the crank, and after every single turn of the crank, we return to the same Hamiltonian. Okay? We're further going to assume that we turn the crank relatively slowly, so the system adiabatically follows whatever happens there. Okay? So this is an adiabatic following problem. And what that implies is that after one pump cycle, the final quantum states, we start in some initial eigenstate psi of q. After one pump cycle, the only thing that could possibly have happened is that you might have acquired a phase. Other than that, you have to end up in exactly the same quantum state by the assumption of adiabaticity. And what that means is that we can describe this particular system in terms of a single cycle evolution operator, which describes these phases that different initial eigenstates would acquire after individual pump cycles. Okay? So it looks like the exponential of some Hermitian operator, which is describing the q-dependent phases that you might acquire. All right? Assuming adiabaticity, this is the most that could happen, provided that you inquire what happened to the system only after some integer number of pump cycles. I'm not specifying what happens between the pump cycles. All right. You can ask questions then. Once you have an evolution operator, you can, for example, ask what happens to the position. So here, we simply ask, how does a position operator evolve after one evolution cycle? And what you see is a position operator returns to itself along with a contribution related to the derivative of this acquired phase with respect to the crystal momentum. All right. I'm pulling another one, a fast one here again. Here I'm talking about position X, and I should really be talking about lattice site I. Okay, so again, you have to think about lattice sites here. That's the trick I'm playing here. In any case, this phase that I previously did not specify has two contributions. One contribution is a dynamical contribution, which reminds us that depending upon the initial eigenstate we started in, one can simply acquire a phase, which is the average over one pump cycle of the eigenenergies associated with the adiabatically following state. If this was the only phase that was acquired, we would then take the Q derivative with respect to this mean energy and observe that the displacement is exactly what we expected. We take the group velocity here, multiply it by the time there, and obtain a displacement delta x. All right. So this single cycle operator, at least in the limit of completely boring physics, returns to what you already knew. There's a displacement related to a group velocity. However, in many physical systems, we can study systems where the mean group velocity is zero. What I'll be describing very briefly is a Bose-Einstein condensate at the minimum of a dispersion relation, at which point the group velocity is always zero. Another circumstance when the group velocity is essentially zero is the case of filled bands. In that case, every crystal momentum state is occupied with equal probability, and you will find that the mean group velocity is generally zero. Right. So in both of those cases, we have to consider an additional contribution to this phase. I specified adiabatic motion, and the other type of phase that we can acquire, which is the centerpiece of this talk, is the Barry's phase. We're going to think about Barry's phases as resulting from effective vector potentials, or later on various curvatures. So we can think about the structure now, the quantum eigenstates. Here, we're asking how these eigenstates depend upon time. Okay, so this is one component of the Barry's connection, and we can integrate that component of the Barry's connection to obtain this phase phi, now a Barry's phase. And what we'll find again is that there's a contribution to the displacement, which is now related to the Q derivative of a Barry's connection here. All right. So this is now thinking about, as we move along our trajectory and parameter space, what's the resulting phase that's acquired from the Barry's phase and expressing it in terms of a Barry's connection. As we're going to begin thinking about geometry and topology later on, we need to think about what is the surface over which this motion is taking place in parameter space. So we're labeling eigenstates in terms of two sort of quantum numbers. One of the quantum numbers is the conventional crystal momentum. That's no surprise. But in addition, now we're labeling these states here in terms of when during the pump cycle did we realize the system. And the eigenstates depend both upon this q and this time t, both of which are 2 pi periodic, meaning that the overall geometry, the structure, the topology is of a torus. So we're labeling eigenstates as to where they fall in a torus. We therefore have a 2-component Berry's connection here. Or later on, we'll be thinking about these curvatures, f mu nu. All right? So the upshot is if we want to determine what the displacement is, we integrate over one pump cycle. We think first about the q derivative of this Berry's connection here. After doing a bit of familiar vector calculus, thinking about this tiny loop involved in taking the q derivative, we finally obtain the result that the net displacement for a particular initial quantum state here is the integral over this path of one component of the Berry's curvature here. So the general picture is that we had some kind of torus-shaped structure. We are thinking about one trajectory, one loop on this torus. And if you want to know then the net displacement of any system that lived in one particular Brillouin zone, you would say, well, the net displacement is going to be the equation I previously showed, along with an integral giving the probability of occupation of those different Q states. Right. So that gives the net displacement generically for any occupation of a particular Brillouin zone. This is then an example of the famous Thallus paper, thinking about topological pumping, in which case these states are occupied with unit probability. And this integral is the integral over the Brillouin zone, simply of this curvature. This integral then counts the number of topological defects or charges on the inside of it, giving rise to quantized pumping. So that's going to be moving to the second part of this. So nominally, contemporaneously, in cold atom physics, these ideas from condensed matter physics have been realized in 3 different contexts. In one context, both in the group, first in the group of Emanuel Bloch in Munich, they realized topological charge pumping using a filled Brillouin zone of bosons constructed initially from a mod insulator. This is a scenario with every state occupied with equal probability. And indeed, after an integer number of pump cycles, a quantized displacement was observed. Simultaneously, with fermions, Takahashi's group in Kyoto also observed a quantized displacement with a filled band of fermions, an insulating fermionic system. And slightly thereafter, we realized a similar situation with Bose-condensed bosons, in which the bosons occupied just one crystal momentum state and gave rise to this dramatically non-quantized motion after these integer number of pump cycles. So this is taking this idea of topological, when every state is occupied with equal probability, pumping resulting from the underlying geometry of these eigenstate structures. So these are ideas from condensed matter physics which can be realized in these highly controllable atomic systems. So as an experimentalist, this whole discussion is very abstract to me. So it sort of begs the question of, well, it did move, we didn't push on it, and what was the force? Okay. So the force is not something that Luke can do at a distance that's semi-mythological. We just need to look a little bit and understand what the origin of the forces is. So now this is our rest period. You know, that seemed complicated to me as an experimentalist. I'm going to go back to something comfortable and familiar, which are 2-level systems. So where I would like to begin thinking now is I'd like to talk about adiabaticity a little bit. And I'm going to start talking about adiabaticity in the way that condensed matter or cold atom physicists are conditioned to think about adiabaticity. So sort of like Pavlov's bell. If someone says adiabaticity and 2-level system, I immediately think Landau's Zener tunneling, and that's not what we want to talk about today. So let me start by reminding you about what I'm not talking about. So we think about an avoided crossing in a 2-level system. So what we're imagining is a Hamiltonian of this general form. We will be thinking about these kind of Hamiltonians for a while. So what we have is a vector of Pauli matrices, these the Pauli matrices, along with a vector of parameters. Okay, so this is the language I'd like to encourage us to use. Vector of parameters. Here there's 3 parameters. These parameters are describing the orientation of something that looks like a magnetic field in the sense of G mu b. All right. We then consider a situation where we have a vector of parameters initially. For example, let's say that the x component is not 0 and the z component is large. This is what I'm sketching here. And we're going to sweep the z component through 0 so that the different orientations, this effective magnetic field, follow the little arrows I've sketched here. In that case, the eigenenergies of the Hamiltonian are no other than the magnitude of that vector of effective magnetic fields, and one obtains a classic, D-classic, I guess, avoided crossing, which is plotted here. The gap in the spectrum is no other than the magnitude of this X component. So the idea, this conditioning that cold atom or atomic physicists have, is we imagine we start in some initial state, sign off the ground state of this Hamiltonian, and fairly slowly sweep this parameter omega z, such as we go through resonance. And if the sweep is adequately slow, we'll move over to this final state, the opposite state, with near unit probability. And what do I mean by near unit probability? I mean that the probability of ending up in the unwanted state is exponentially small in 1 over the sweep rate. All right, so that is, you could always sweep sufficiently slowly, and this phenomenon then of adiabatic fast or rapid passage allows us to very effectively change between states. Now, of course, it's not perfect. If we start, for example, in this initial state, psi up, and we sweep adiabatically following, we're going to end near the ground state, but not exactly in the ground state because, of course, we're not perfect. Okay, great. Let's see. What do I want to say here? So I guess my question now that we want to think about as we move forward in this talk is there more? And the way I want to think about the question, is there more, let's imagine a family of trajectories subject to the constraint that the magnitude of this effective magnetic field is constant. All right. So now we want to think about a situation where, yeah, we're moving around a magnetic field in parameter space. We're not changing the magnitude of that magnetic field. And we'd still like to ask the question of how likely is it that we started in the ground state and ended up in the excited state after this sweep, we would think we'd be adiabatic. We can be slow compared to this gap, but what happens here? All right, so let's see. What am I wanting to illustrate with this one? So the first one is that I'm going to start using a language. These circles are going to represent, in this particular case, the control parameter space. These are the knobs available to us as an experimentalist, and here it's being described as a vector of effective magnetic fields. So this control parameter space is right now distinct from the Bloch sphere. So I'm not plotting the states. And we say now we start in some initial state here. For example, we might have initially polarized the system in an eigenstate with the control field along the x direction. And we might imagine sweeping out a trajectory in the equator of this sphere. That's an example trajectory. And asking what's the probability of ending up still in the ground state or having undergone an unwanted non-adiabatic transition to the excited state. And what you find is that the probability of excitation, of ending up in the unwanted state, is now simply, in the limit of fairly slow motion, linear in the rate, rather than exponentially small in 1 over the rate. So this is quite different. In fact, if you keep the gap constant, it's relatively difficult to be adiabatic. Right? So in this talk, then, is going to be about the quantitative meaning of the breakdown of that kind of adiabaticity. And to do that, I would like to remind you then of the Barry's connection, and a Barry's connection which has a plethora of indices. All right, so right now we're thinking about a Barry's connection which is simply going to be a vector of numbers. Right now I was talking about a two-level system. We should be shortly thinking about systems with more levels. We're going to be labeling eigenstates with an integer n. So my Barry's connection here is going to come with an integer n, specifying which of these eigenstates we're going to be thinking about. I was thinking previously about motion and parameter space. Okay, that parameter space sort of had a geometry to it. And we're going to need to take derivatives in that parameter space. So that's r mu. The mu is the direction. So my Barry's connection is going to have a label mu here. That's going to be the direction in parameter space. And of course, it has a value which is different depending upon different points in parameter space. All right, so it's going to be a function of where you are in parameter space along the direction which the derivative was taken in parameter space. All right, great. And of course, from this Barry's connection, we can construct the curvature tensor. So curvature tensors are starting to get to be words that experimentalists are a little bit uncomfortable with. But we can see that this curvature tensor looks a whole lot like a magnetic field, and I'll make that connection explicit momentarily. So it looks like it has a contribution which is somewhat like an anti-symmetric term. And shortly, we're going to care about a second term here, which is a commutator term. And the case of degenerate manifolds are cases where you think about multiple states, you need to think about this commutator term for non-abelian vector fields. All right. So let's go back to that two-level system, our recovery system. So my control parameter space is a three-dimensional parameter space, and we're thinking about moving about by controlling something in that three-dimensional parameter space. If we think then about the Barry's connection looks like the conventional electromagnetic vector potential. It's a three-component vector. If we look then about how the three-component vector builds to make this curvature tensor, we see that the various off-diagonal elements of the curvature tensor are no more than the components of the magnetic field generated from the curl. That's not surprising because we saw we had an anti-symmetric term here that gives rise to the regular components of the magnetic field. So the magnetic field, in the usual sense, can be constructed by summing over different elements of this curvature tensor. The remainder of this talk is about the effective force, which I first learned about anyway from a nice paper of Anna Kolyapokolnikov, which thought about these forces in generalized parameter spaces. And what they showed in linear response, relatively slow motion, is that the force a quantum state experiences is essentially this curvature tensor dotted into the direction along which you move in parameter space, giving rise to a generalized force. If we think in this three-dimensional parameter space, in which case this curvature is related to a magnetic field, a small amount of algebra will show us that the effective force that these atoms experience is no more than a generalized Lorentz force in the space of parameters. Right. So this is sort of reproducing interesting physics in the space of parameters. Okay. So this is the force that's experienced by a quantum state in state space as you move about in parameter space. And I'll be having a graphical version of this. So this motion in parameter space and asking what happens in state space is another way of saying what the underlying force is in the case of this topological geometrical pump. In that case, the parameter space was defined by crystal momentum along one direction and time along the other, and we executed some trajectory in that parameter space and asked how did the state change. And it was the change in the state that ultimately gave rise to the deflections we observed. The same algebra is the algebra that gives rise to the anomalous force is present in band structures. If you try to, for example, drive block oscillations and observe transverse forces, that anomalous force can also be thought about in this context of this generalized force. So this way of thinking about generalized forces captures a lot of topological geometric forces. And now we're going to try to probe this, control it, in an experimentally tuned quantum system where everything is in parameter space. And I'll be showing you the different components of parameter space as we go now. All right, so this is my cartoon. So now we're moving on to having had our rest period of two-level systems. We're going to start building to the experiment we've done. Okay, so what we're going to be doing is measuring topological invariants, Chern numbers. Notice it's plural now, so we'll be thinking about more than the usual first Chern number. And we're going to use this to characterize the non-trivial topology of eigenstates on experimentally defined manifolds. All right, so this slide is meant to sort of recapture what I said before. So previously, we thought about a two-level system. We thought about moving around in the parameter space of that two-level system, and I pointed out to you that in that two-level system, a magnetic field can appear that results from a Barry's curvature. And what I didn't point out is that the magnitude of that magnetic field diverges as one moves towards the origin of parameter space when the gap of the two-level system closes. That corresponds to, in that parameter space's effective magnetic field or expected curvature, there being a Dirac monopole, a usual magnetic, usual in the sense it doesn't exist in the real world, but at least you can think of it, a Dirac monopole existing at the origin of parameter space. With that sort of structure in mind, we then can understand how to classify what different surfaces in parameter space look like by simply counting the number of monopoles on the inside of them. Right, so this is simply Gauss's law applied for a magnetic field. The idea is if a monopole exists in the inside of some surface, if you integrate the magnetic field penetrating that surface, you will count the number of sources or charges in the inside of that surface. This counting of charges or quantum defects on the inside of a surface is what ultimately gave rise to the Chern numbers I described before. Remember, I showed you an equation for Chern number, which is no more than the integral of an orthogonally aligned curvature over that surface. That was like a z component or perpendicular component of a curvature that in the end counted the number of sources inside of that what was a torus. So charge pumping resulted from defects in the set of direct monopoles in that system. Right. So we're defining here the churn number is the integral over a surface of the normal component of one of these curvature matrices. Again, along with some unit surface normal. Right. So this is usual sort of Gauss's law, but applied to these direct monopoles. All right. Let's see. So as I showed before, we'll be thinking about various connections. So these direct monopoles, what are they coming from? They're coming from the structure of the eigenstates of Hamiltonians. So we have a Hamiltonian that's a function of parameter space. The eigenstates of the Hamiltonian go into defining a various connection. From that various connection, we define essentially the magnetic field or the gauge field strength. Okay, so this is how these things interconnect with one another. And we integrate over manifolds to obtain churn numbers. Now, unfortunately for me, we're going to think about more complicated churn numbers. We have to use a notation which goes beyond the simple electromagnetism notation that's familiar in undergraduate physics. So we're going to redefine or re-express the first churn number here as an integral over the surface of the wedge product of the two surface vectors, summed over, we've implied summation convention over the different components of the curvature matrix. So the idea is that this wedge product simply gives you the surface normal in this case, and by summing over with an anti-symmetric epsilon ijk term, which then pulls out the magnetic field like I showed you before from this curvature term, giving back the familiar Gauss's law. But what we would like to think about is not the first churn number, but the family of churn numbers. For example, here we'll be measuring the second churn number, which is a related quantity, but now is the integral over a four-dimensional surface living in a five-dimensional parameter space. We still have a wedge product to give the surface normal, but we also have a wedge product of not one, but two of these curvatures to obtain the second churn number quantity. Secondly, we're going to be thinking about a degenerate manifold of states, meaning that the various curvature itself and the various connection are themselves matrix-valued quantities or quantities that are operators. Therefore, to obtain the correct various curvature, we need to also keep in mind that the different component of the various connection are non-commuting. So we're going to have a non-commuting vector potential, a non-abelian gauge field, which is engineered in the parameter space of a quantum system. So going beyond anything I know about, so that you guys may know about this, many or most of you are theorists, the second churn number and the first churn number are just different examples of the general concept of a churn form. Each of these churn forms can be used to classify manifolds in parameter space. For example, I talked about the first churn number. That's a manifold in a two-dimensional parameter space, or three-dimensional parameter space on a two-dimensional surface. We're now going to go on to talk about the second churn number, which is a four-dimensional manifold in a five-dimensional parameter space, and on and on. Okay. All right, great. So now we have an idea. We're going to use generalized forces to figure out what the various curvature is on different places on the surface of manifolds. We're going to move a quantum system almost but not quite adiabatically in parameter space and inquire as to how well the system followed and how much was left behind. From that, we're going to determine the curvature. We're going to perform an integral to obtain the churn number. All right, so as a warm-up exercise, we construct a two-level system. And this has been done in the context of superconducting qubits and resonators in these papers I cite down here. So for us, it's now a warm-up exercise. I want to explicitly show you the Hamiltonian. So we're working now with rubidium-87 atoms. We select out two internal states of rubidium-87. This is selected from convenience of the experimentalist. So it's MF equals minus 1 in one manifold, and MF equals 0 in the second manifold, linked together by a microwave coupling field. In the rotating frame, this gives rise to the Hamiltonian I described before, a fully controllable Hamiltonian describing a two-level system. By controlling the strength and phase of this oscillator along with this frequency, we can trace out an arbitrary curve in parameter space. These circles are meant to denote the concept I was trying to illustrate before, where we have a control parameter space describing the knobs we're turning in the laboratory. And here we have the block sphere describing the state space. So we want to know what happens in state space as we do things almost adiabatically in parameter space. We're then going to measure, again, the effective force acting in state space as a result of the motion in parameter space to obtain the curvatures here, and with those curvatures in hand, figure out Turing numbers. So here's what happens. We start at some initial point here in parameter space, also in an eigenstate. We then begin sweeping, in this case, along the equator of the Bloch sphere. And it's a two-level system. We easily do full-state tomography and measure what happens. If the motion was fully adiabatic, you would never expect a z component to the motion. The polarizing field is always in the xy plane. And we see that, by and large, the motion follows adiabatically. We're initially located here, polarized along the y direction. We execute a ramp, and afterwards we're along the negative y direction. And the in-between part, we became oriented along the negative x direction. Very good. But in addition, there was a small component along the z direction resulting from the non-adiabatic trace we had. Okay. From this component along the z direction, we obtain one component of this curvature tensor. We then use the symmetry of the system. We know that our Hamiltonian was always azimuthally symmetric along this axis. And from that, integrate and obtain the Turing number. And using this method, one obtains a measurement of the Turing number quantity to be one with some experimental uncertainty living on it. So this general technique works, and the two references I previously cited have done a somewhat better job than we did in our warm-up exercise. So the way to think about this, the next thing we can do is take the manifold that we're moving and have it not initially located along the center of parameter space. So this was the manifold we just studied. We can move the control parameter space manifold, always a sphere, but in such a way that at some point the origin of the parameter space, the location of this Dirac monopole, is no longer enclosed within the control parameter space manifold. And we find that this quantity, the Turing number that we measure, continuously changes from being 1 here to being 0 here when the sphere totally does not enclose this point. Now, you might ask yourself, how is it that this quantity you're so nicely claiming to be an integer is measured to be quite decidedly non-integer over a range of parameters? And here, this results from a breakdown of the adiabaticity criterion. As we are moving this sphere to not enclose this point, the gap in the spectrum is getting smaller and smaller as we approach the location of this singular point here, and the assumption of linear response and adiabaticity completely fail. So experiments, as was done with superconducting qubits that ramp more slowly, can see a much more sharp step feature here. All right. So the upshot is that by constructing a two-level system, we have a three-dimensional parameter space, and living at the origin of that three-dimensional parameter space is just one magnetic monopole.
Why can't you ramp slower?
Yeah, it's because of decoherence. So these ramps are already something like 10 millisecond ramps. If our goal in life had been to do this really well, we would have worked on the clock transition and could have done much better. But unfortunately, you're going to see in a second that the states we have to use for the fancy case don't have a clock transition available. So here are some calculations of what happens if you ramp increasingly more slowly. All right. So to summarize, we constructed a two-level system. The associated topological invariant on the two-dimensional manifold that we constructed, which was a sphere, it can be the first Turing number, and it results from a Dirac monopole living in parameter space, associated with a single point in parameter space where a twofold degeneracy is present. To make myself sound fancy, as a result of this, a U1, that is to say, normal electromagnetic vector potential appeared. All right. So now what we're going to do is...
Just one question on the previous slide where 2-1, 2 before.
Okay, yeah.
Yes, so that is a calculation?
Right, that's a calculation.
And the one at the velocity that you actually did the experiment coincides with the...
Oh, yeah, so okay. The red curve is the theory for that experiment. Okay, so what we're going to do then is construct a four-level system. And this four-level system, the source of effective magnetic field, rather than being a Dirac monopole, instead is going to be what's called a Yang monopole. So it will be a source of a non-abelian vector field. All right. So to sort of take what I told you before, remember that we created a system which was the inner product of a direction and parameter space along with the vector of Pauli matrices. And we constructed it by linking together a pair of states here in this two-level Hamiltonian manifold. We're now going to extend that way of thinking about it. We're going to couple together four internal states within the ground state manifolds of Rubidium 87, so both the F equals 1 and F equals 2 manifold. We're going to couple them together with a pair of microwave fields and a pair of RF fields. And for the experimentalist in the audience, we're working at large enough magnetic field that each of these transitions is individually addressed by a different oscillator. So there are four oscillating fields here, and we individually control the phase and amplitude of those fields. By insisting that the acquired phase upon enclosing this one loop in parameter space be phi, along with insisting that the relative phases of these different coupling terms be written as I have done here, in other words, the greenish ones have the same amplitude but different phase by pi, and the blue ones have the same amplitude but different phase by nothing at all. Just having the opposite phase. You can find that the Hamiltonian for this case can be written as a five-vector in parameter space dotted into a vector not of Pauli matrices but rather of Dirac matrices. Okay, so this is not the fully general four-level system. Rather, this is the four-level Hamiltonian that can be expressed in the same form as we did with the two-level system, but rather than having Dirac matrices, Pauli matrices, we have Dirac matrices. Okay. Yeah?
Just out of curiosity, you chose that particular detuning structure. Yeah, this particular detuning structure to make certain everything is essentially virtual in its hopping, or is the detuning also going to be a control parameter?
The detuning is one of the R's. So one of the Dirac matrices is the detuning in the way it was constructed here.
But all the correlations I see in the detuning here are the ones that you'd like.
That's right. Okay. Any detuning that is not present here is called experimental mistake. Or background magnetic field. So an important feature of these Dirac matrices is that each and every one of them is twofold degenerate. So there's a twofold degenerate pair of ground state and a twofold degenerate pair of excited states, each of which has energies plus and minus one. So the spectrum of these Hamiltonians looks exactly the same as our two-level case did before. There's a gap in the spectrum whose magnitude is no more than the magnitude of the vector R in parameter space. So it looks an awful lot like the previous problem, excepting for the fact that each of these states is now twofold degenerate. So to reiterate, if we construct a sphere of unit radius in parameter space, every point in that parameter space shares the same spectrum. But now, if we look within, for example, this pair of degenerate states, to fully specify the state in state space, we need a different auxiliary block sphere that expresses the superpositions that are present within this degenerate manifold of states. So altogether, what this means is we have a five-dimensional control parameter space. We'll be moving around vectors in five space. At the origin of this parameter space, again, the gap in the spectrum drops to zero. And that gap, that location with the gap in the spectrum is zero, is the location of the source of whatever curvatures we're going to be observing. So there's a source in the center of this. As we move about in control parameter space, firstly, there's a five sphere, which is analogous to the block sphere in the three-level case, that describes the overall magnetization along these different directions in parameter space defined by the Dirac matrices. But in addition to that magnetization, there's the auxiliary block sphere, which is describing the superpositions present within the superpositions, all of which would have the same magnetization in parameter space. So, for example, as you trace out a loop in state space, in parameter space, even if you had been perfectly adiabatic and ended up where you started, you could end up in a different point in parameter space, and that motion is called the Wilczek Z phase or a Wilczek Z operator. All right. Okay, so we constructed this system. The first thing we need to do as experimentalists is to demonstrate that we can observe what we would like to observe. So we devised a series of experimental protocols to measure the direction of the magnetization in parameter space. That is to say, upon starting at a particular point in parameter space, we can sweep out a loop. And as we sweep out this loop in parameter space, we observe that the different expectation value of all five of the Dirac matrices nearly adiabatically follow the red curves, which would be the adiabatically following trajectories, with small breakdowns from adiabaticity resulting from this generalized force. And that calculation is, of course, there in black. So what I'm plotting on this graph is the expectation value of the gamma 4 matrix along a trajectory such as this one, where we are expecting it to be zero. And an important and essential point about this multi-level system is now that we have a degenerate manifold, in addition to asking what was the initial magnetization, which in the case of the Bloch sphere up to a phase to fully define the initial state, you must also prepare an initial state which could be different within different points inside the degenerate manifold. And what you observe is that the expectation value of the Dirac matrix that had it been adiabatic would be zero, differs depending upon which initial state in parameter space you started in. So this is sort of a plot of the sort of pseudo Bloch sphere defining where you are in the degenerate manifold, and we're starting on different states, color-coded by these different points. And what we observe is different deflections depending upon those different initial states. All right. So what this is saying is that the generalized force we observe is not only going to be depend on the path and parameter space, but also the initial state. And this is one of the postdocs, Eshu Sagawa, who worked on this, his theoretical contributions, is to derive the extension to the generalized force equation. So the upshot is by following a particular trajectory and parameter space, we can measure a component of the curvature tensor. Now, the curvature tensor is vastly more complicated than it had previously been. So firstly, rather than being a 3x3 matrix, it's now a 5x5 matrix. And moreover, rather than every component of the curvature being a scalar, it itself is a 2x2 matrix describing curvature within this degenerate manifold. So in any case, we can measure the different components of that. For example, for the ramp we're describing here, we see that, by and large, the curvature tensor is aligned along the sigma z direction and is radially oriented, which is pretty close to what we were expecting theoretically. An important point now that we're doing real science rather than just testing what we can do is confirming that in the situation we're studying, we are indeed being adiabatic. So this is a plot of the measured geometric force as a function of the full ramp rate, how long it took us to execute one cycle. The experimental symbols are here. Linear response, when are we in a linear response regime, is of course when we follow these lines, and the full simulation, the dashed lines, show that indeed the experiment has a breakdown of linear response exactly when we expect it to. Okay. In addition, we can ask ourselves, confirm that indeed we're observing something that looks like a monopole source. So a monopole source, even in the five-dimensional parameter space, has a magnitude, a field, that looks like a 1 over r squared scaling for the curvatures. We can indeed observe that as we change the magnitude of the coupling strength, that is the size of the sphere in parameter space, the magnitude of this geometric force does indeed increase as 1 over r when the coupling goes to 0. So our measurement technique is working. We're indeed measuring magnitudes of these geometric forces as expected. We're going to be inside the linear response regime. The task then is to measure a sufficiently large number of these curvature tensor components such that we can then apply the symmetry of the Hamiltonian to integrate over the Hamiltonian and obtain the second turn number. So once you have the experiment working, it takes about a month of data taking to obtain that amount of data, and we find that the second turn number, which in fact can only take on the integer values of -1, 0, or +1, is observed to be +1 in the ground state, -1 for the excited state, all within the expected parameters. We can perform the experiment I described previously for the two-level system, that is to say, move now the four-sphere in the five-dimensional parameter space away from the origin, and observe that the second Chern number does indeed drop from being 1 to being 0 in the ground state, or rise from being -1 to 0 in the excited state. And here the simulation for the exact trajectory we followed are the solid curves, and ever more slow trajectories are given by the ever more pale curves. So to the extent we are in the linear response regime, this experiment is indeed measuring this quantity called the second Chern number. We can also encircle that point in parameter space by a range of two-dimensional manifolds and attempt to measure the first Chern number. And what we find is that for every such manifold, the first Chern number is 0. And what that tells us is that the source of the topological transition we're observing is resulting from a monopole source that has no first Chern number and only has a second Chern number. And this kind of monopole is the Yang monopole. And this is me after I showed Professor Yang his monopole. So it's pretty cool. So he predicted this type of monopole as existing in Yang-Mills field theories, in this case in the late 70s. And now in cold atom context, in a generalized parameter space, we've gotten to realize it. So I thought that was relatively cool. Anyway.
So that was in the summer,
yeah,
August?
Yeah, that was this summer.
In this conference?
Yeah.
Is that the famous CFT group on the table?
What's that?
Yeah.
The book on the table is about idiot CFT.
Okay. So anyway, so what we've done, so to summarize the experiment, I think I'll end the talk here real quick. We have constructed a controllable parameter space. So in the lab, we constructed a bunch of parameters we could control, five of them. And then we worked really hard to control them very well. And inside that parameter space, we embedded a four-dimensional manifold and moved the parameter so the Hamiltonian was described by the Hamiltonian on that manifold. This gave us a set of eigenstates that produced a monopole at the origin of parameter space, and we were therefore able to characterize the topology of the source of that monopole. Right, so I think I'd like to end with a bit of outlook and conclusion here. So you can look at that slide, but it actually doesn't contain what I'm going to talk about. So I tried to make clear what we've done here. So it's a parameter space, and we've controlled that parameter space. I led off my talk by talking about the topological pumping. And there, part of the parameter space was what you sort of, as experimentalists, think about as physical parameters, so like a direction with a momentum associated with it. And you executed a pump trajectory and saw motion. And only one of the directions of parameter space, the time direction, was a little bit sketchy. So it was almost a legitimate parameter space. So this is the experimentalist talking. So the question is, if you take an experiment like this, where does this begin to connect again to more dynamical, if you want, parameter spaces? And it turns out that if you thought about two-level systems in a language, if you thought about the charge pumping in a language I didn't use, ultimately you almost always can boil it down to an effective spin model of left sites and right sites, or spins up and spin downs. And in that case, that two-level system has a Hamiltonian just like the R dot Pauli matrices I had before. And the motion on that is now the motion in that two-level system's parameter space that gives rise to the curvatures and the pumping. So in the same sense here, you can construct not doublets, not double-wall lattices, but four-site lattices, little triangular plaquettes, arrange them in a three-dimensional space. And this three-dimensional space can have a degenerate manifold, a degenerate band structure. And that degenerate band structure in three-space has kx, ky, kz, and time. That's a four-dimensional surface. And the charge pumping in this kind of case is an extension of the two-level case, but now the type of quantized charge pumping that can be observed is sensitive to the second Chern number and is in detail sensitive to things such as the initial state prepared in that manifold. So it's a new kind of charge pumping that can be realized with four-sight three-dimensional lattices in this situation. So I give this as an example of sort of physics that can result from this because it is completely, although complicatedly, within this realm of actual cold atom experiment, where some of the other things I talk about down here, such as simulating high energy physics, is much more complicated and not within the immediate reach of experiment. So that's how I'd like to end the talk. And there's a number of bonus materials that I'm not going to go into that if you'd like to talk about, I can show about how we measure Wilczek Z phases and Wilson loops and things like that with this system. So thank you very much for your time and attention. Okay, so any questions on that? Okay, yeah.
How do you know within the experiment is this what you measure and not some other? So what is the signature that you usually measure is quantum pumping and not some classical effect?
So you're thinking about the first part of my talk, the pumping experiment?
Yes.
Well, I guess before I answer that question, can you tell me what you think of it, what is a classical effect, so I can...
Like a classical Archimedean pump.
Okay, great. Perfect. So this I can address. And if I need to, I'll go to the slides. So I set the stage to think about the optical lattice version of a classical Archimedean pump is when the optical lattice becomes really quite deep, the band becomes quite flat. You become pinned to the lattice sites in a very classical seeming sense. And whether even if you had an extended state, like a BEC, or if you had localized states, you would always sort of move with the lattice. And we'll go ahead and call that sort of the classical kind of effect, the co-moving lattice effect.
Yeah, but that's not quite true, because there's the gap, and in fact, just a sliding lattice is a trivial limit of the Fowler's problem. So right. Only if it's classical, it's only classical if there would be no energy gap to the first excited state. Then you would indeed have no charge pumping because it would start sloshing around, I mean, because a classical particle would start moving around as you accelerate the lattice and decelerate. But the GAN band gap in the first band always, so even the sliding lattice, and admittedly a very trivial regime of this Fowler's pump, and has quantized, I would say.
Yeah, so the, I think the closing the gap, the ground excited state gap in the spectrum probably was beyond that question. But the, so the sort of, what Emmanuel called the sliding lattice limit. So for the BEC, in order for that to be, for a Bose gas, for a condensed Bose gas to be in that limit, you have to have an adequately flat, it's never going to be perfectly quantized in that case. You'll never perfectly follow the lattice. But for all practical purposes, you will follow the lattice when the effective mass is, you know, incredibly close to zero. That's a deep lattice limit. So that's one limit. So that's the limit in which the system looks like an optical standing wave, where you simply vary the phase and the lattice moves. And in fact, so now I think I do need a slide. This particular talk doesn't have all the fancy color plots in it that I want to illustrate that. I could sketch them on the board. But in this graph here, so the data from my experiment, the sliding lattice limit, in fact, on this axis is both -1 and +1. All right. So what you're observing is that for the particular lattice parameters we had near whatever, this is called an imbalance parameter, near the imbalance parameter of -1, we are observing almost quantized displacement for a BEC in this lattice with a displacement of about 1 per pump cycle. And on the opposite phase, when the lattice moves along the opposite direction, you see almost -1. So sort of in response to your question about when can we just say this is very classical looking, and when is it kind of quantum looking? Well, quantum always describes what we see. There's no limit in which quantum stops working and it just is classical. But quantum captures the classically intuitive sliding lattice limits. Now, for the VEC, you'll notice that the theory curve, this is the gray curve here, doesn't quite intersect at 1. Right? And this is the effect I was referring to, telling you about before, that this band always has an effective mass which has not yet gone to zero, so you'll never see a quite quantized displacement for a Bose gas. In contrast, for this particular, in this case, if we had done this experiment with fermions or initial Mott insulator, we would have discovered that everything that's below zero on this would be +1, and everything that's above zero here would be -1. And two of those limits would be the sliding lattice limit, sort of exactly realized. Okay, so I guess my answer to your question is, how do we know it's not just classical pumping? Because it's not quantized when the theory says it should not be.
Actually, maybe just to add, maybe you can also reach a regime where it's very counterintuitive, where actually the Chern number is reversed, where you're moving the lattice like that, you're dragging like that, but actually particles move in the opposite direction. Yeah. And that's not what classical particles do. That quantum tunneling is for sure. And you can see that.
So let me ask another question. Is there an effective Planck's constant in this result? Is there some quantity of these quantities that you measure? Does it have H bar over some action?
I don't think there's any emergent Planck's constant in this problem. I think it's the problem is I'm such a cold atom experimentalist by now. I just respond by saying it's quantum.
Okay, anyway, let's
one more question. So in your experiment, can you enforce some symmetries for your four levels and the parameter space such that you can observe some other topological invariants?
I would say for the four-level system that we did the experiment in, we have adequately good experimental control that we can construct every possible link on that plaquette, even the ones we didn't construct, with the same level of control we constructed the ones we had. So that means we can artificially produce any symmetry within the construction of the four-level system that you might be interested in having. And in fact, the vector of Dirac matrices has the artificially imposed time reversal symmetry constraint, which is what you gave us the doublets of degenerate states. So I didn't mention that, but that time reversal symmetry is what gave us a Cramer's degeneracy that enforced that degeneracy. But again, they're fake symmetries in the sense that we're controlling knobs really well and fine-tuning parameters so it looks symmetric. Yeah?
I have an experimental question, actually.
Okay.
With what kind of precision do you need to control the phases of your modulated lattices? Can you do that with regular RF methods?
Oh. So let's... I'll just have this as an example. In our experiment, in our particular deployment of the experiment, I had a cartoon of that here, somewhere there. In our particular realization of this, I'll answer your question in a second. We use state-sensitive transitions, so we had MF equals -1, 0, and +1 all at play. And to decent intuitive level, phase noise on the oscillator is the same as magnetic field. It gives the same outcomes as magnetic field noise. So in our experiment, we were dominated by the magnetic field fluctuations and not phase noise on the oscillator. So I would say that phase noise pretty much, in terms of what you can buy as RF equipment, is completely irrelevant to these experiments. And then you can ask second order questions like, if you have phase noise on your oscillators, what's the spectrum of phase noise? And that adds a time dependence to your Hamiltonian that you can try to understand by looking at what's the excitation rate to unwanted states and things of this type.
Okay, so there's an extensive kind of literature around what's called holonomic quantum computing. Uh-huh. Where one takes, for example, dark states, you know, in many endpoints and so on, different Rabi frequency, yeah. And then one has a certain amount of parameter space, so one is able to build up very general rotations.
Uh-huh.
So is what you do sort of a version of this, or is it actually different?
Okay, so I was... what we do is the one qubit version of that. So
are the states which you have over here actually dark states in your Fourier system? I guess not, right?
Yeah, right. So they're not dark states. They're not zero energy states. Because there's no spontaneous emission, there's no real sense in which darkness is particularly important. They are a degenerate pair of states, and the degeneracy is enforced by artificially imposed symmetries like the previous question. So as long as we move in parameter space and enforce those symmetries, in this case we can do any one qubit rotation we want in an adiabatic, a completely adiabatic motion. So it's the most straightforward implementation of that, those kind of ideas.
Okay, so if there's no question anymore, so Ian is here till tomorrow.
So yes, I'll be here till tomorrow.
And also, very important, you have to be aware that we have to kind of make a soccer team by tomorrow, so prepare yourself. Let's thank you again for your time.